The Apostle Paul ends near the end of his first letter to the Corinthians with these words. He says, "Be watchful, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong, let all that you do be done in love." Now, ladies, I'm not being sexist, and Paul is not telling Christian women to abandon their femininity and try to act like men. That's not what's going on in that verse. He's telling the church at Corinth to not be wimps. Be strong, be courageous, stand firm in the faith. Now, why would such a command be needed? Why are there instructions throughout Scripture to press on, to persevere? Jesus came to give us abundant life. If he says, "I've come that they might have life and have it to the full," so if that is what Jesus has promised, why do we need to be strong and courageous? Didn't Jesus promise us an easy yoke? He said, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." You know, Jesus does promise his followers an easy yoke. And he does promise them abundant life. And he absolutely keeps his promises. But we saw last week in Revelation that there is a dragon and that dragon wants to destroy. The dragon, which is the devil, wants to devour people created in the image of God, and in particular, he hates God's people, the church. Satan hates God, but Satan can't get at God. He's been kicked out of heaven. He can't get at God, and even if he could, there's nothing he could do against God, so he turns his attack towards God's people. And the dragon has some friends. There are two beasts in the book of Revelation. We'll call him the sea beast because he comes out of the sea, and the land beast because he comes out of the land. Now, we need to get to know these beasts because they are on the loose on the earth. So who or what is the beast? Well, the sea beast, you'll see, looks a lot like the dragon. He has seven heads. He's got 10 horns. And the dragon gives the beast his power and authority. It is obvious that this beast that comes out of the sea is in league with Satan. He's not a good guy. The beast comes from the sea. The way the Jews would have seen the sea, it was a place of chaos. It was a place of confusion. The tide was always going out and in. It was not stable. It was a place that was a place of danger. Storms just could rise up on the sea without no warning. So we see this beast is coming from a place where he is obviously an enemy. And the beast is powerful. Verse 4, it says, "Who can fight against the beast? It was allowed to make war against the saints." Verse 7 says it was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation. The beast is given that authority. The beast says things that are arrogant and blasphemous. It says things that are untrue and defamatory towards God. And, you noticed, against God's dwelling. Remember when we were talking about the temple? We saw that the temple represented God's people. The temple was the place in the Old Testament where God dwelled. And now he dwells in his people. He dwells in the church. And so these attacks and these blasphemous things come against the dwelling of God. They come against the people of God. It says those who dwell in heaven. Now, that doesn't mean just the people who are already dead and have gone to heaven. You see throughout Revelation, you got these two groups of people. You got the heaven dwellers and you got the earth dwellers. And the heaven dwellers, some of them are in heaven, some of them are still in earth, but heaven is really their true home. They know that this isn't their home. But then you have those who dwell on the earth. And they are the ones who are following Satan, the Lord of this earth. Throughout Revelation, you have these divisions, these twos. heaven dwellers, earth dwellers. We saw the woman. There's going to be another woman later. And here in chapter 13, we need to think about who this sea beast is. Now, a popular view and one that's likely portrayed in books and movies you may have read or seen is that the sea beast refers to one particular ruler that is coming at the end of time. Sometimes he's referred to as the Antichrist, who he'll have authority over the entire earth at the end times. And so then, because of that, you have questions that have been asked throughout history, like, is Adolf Hitler or was Adolf Hitler the Antichrist or at the time he was alive? Is Barack Obama the Antichrist? Did anybody hear that one? Has anybody heard now in recent days, is Donald Trump the Antichrist? Is Donald Trump the beast? And it's possible that there could be such a ruler that is coming in the future. But if we limit the beast to only someone coming in the future, we run a great danger of not being prepared for the things that must soon take place. The scripture I read earlier from Daniel, did you notice any similarities between what Daniel saw and what John saw? Daniel 7:17, just a few verses after the passage I read, says, "These four beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth." And nearly every commentary you will read says those four kings refer to four particular empires in the ancient world: Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire, Greece, and Rome. Those four kings are referring to empires that came in the ancient world. And with the way John uses imagery from the Old Testament, and Daniel being one of the Old Testament books that actually uses the same kind of imagery in apocalyptic language that John uses in Revelation, we can be almost certain that John writes Revelation chapter 13, and he wants you to think about what Daniel saw in Daniel 7. When he sees this beast, he knows, and he wants you to know that, okay, these beasts in Daniel, now here is another beast that we need to know what to do with. And it means that the image of the beast is referring to a king or a kingdom. And the image fits as well. A horn is a common apocalyptic symbol for a king, for a ruler. The beast has authority and a throne like a king. It tells us that right in the text. But then the question is, which king is represented? What king is this talking about? And again, we have to think, how would John have written this? How would he have expected his initial readers to understand what he wrote? And there is almost without a doubt that they would have said, oh, John's writing about Nero. He's writing about the Roman emperor, the one who's persecuting the church, the one who is putting Christians up on posts and lighting the city by lighting them on fire. Surely Nero is this king, this ruler, who is coming against the people of God with satanic rage. But I think if we think this is just Nero, and oh, well, that the beast is already gone, we don't have to worry about him, then again, we're not going to be prepared in the way we need to be. Look at verse 3. One of the beast's heads had what seemed to be a mortal wound, but the wound was healed. Now, it's kind of, you try to get your mind right. How do you heal a mortal wound? A mortal wound kills. But how do you heal a mortal wound? Well, one of the beasts, one of the heads, had a mortal wound that was healed. Well, if you look at Roman history, after Nero, it looked like the Roman Empire was dying. Over a period of about 18 months, there were three different emperors. And it looked like the Roman Empire was just disintegrating. But then the power of the Roman Empire was renewed. It was like it was brought back to life. And here is the reality of the beast. Yes, Nero was the beast. But like there was Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and then Cyrus of Persia, and Alexander the Great, Caesar Augustus, and all the other Roman emperors, totalitarian dictators who ruled with an iron fist and demanded complete allegiance of everyone under their authority, some of which actually were required people to refer to them as Lord and God. They set themselves up as gods to the people that they ruled. Because after Nero and after the fall of the Roman Empire, the reality is the beast is still there. It will still be there. It'll have a different name. It will look differently. It might be in a different location. But the beast will still be standing in opposition to God and his people. One commentator described the beast in this way: deification of secular authority. Some big words. Deification of secular authority is a secular authority coming in place and saying, we're the ones that you got to obey without question. You got to do what we say, and it doesn't matter what your God says. It doesn't matter what else you believe. You need to obey the government. You obey the king. You obey the moral standard of this world. It's a concrete, physical manifestation of Satan. Satan is putting his deceptive forces at work through a government, through a person who is in a place of authority. So this beast is on the loose. It's been on the loose since Jesus ascended to heaven, and it will be on the loose until Jesus returns. You see the 42 months in verse 5? It's that 3.5-year period again. It's this time of intense suffering that will come to an end. This is the tribulation, and during this time, there will be governments and there will be other institutions of power that will speak blasphemy. They will wage war against the people of God. That's been happening ever since Jesus ascended to heaven, and it will happen until he returns. And the beast will stop at nothing less than total submission. It goes out to conquer. The beast wants your worship. It's powerful. Those who worship the beast say, who is like the beast? Who can fight against the beast? Who can stand against it? And those who don't worship it, those who stand against the beast are conquered by the beast. And the beast doesn't care whether it speaks the truth or not. It blasphemes against God. It blasphemes against you, the people of God. The beast wants to mold you into its image. The beast wants you to become like it. You see, the beast wants to bring out your inner beast. It's why Paul warns us to not be conformed to the pattern of this world. It's why Paul says that the gospel teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions. See, the beast knows what the psalmist knew in Psalm 115, that you become like what you worship. Those who make them, this is Psalm 115, verse 8, those who make them, speaking of idols, become like them. So do all who trust in them. You will become like what you worship. And you were created in the image of God. You were created to reflect the goodness and the beauty and the wisdom of God to the world around you. Every person on the planet was created in the image of God, but the beast wants to distort that image. The beast wants to tear apart what God is building up. And so it goes after people. So the beast does this work trying to mold people, trying to mold you into its image. We see governments do this. We look at communist governments that have persecuted the church. You know, they thought they could make things so difficult for people who worship God that they would just stop worshiping God. But we've seen over and over and over throughout history that when governments try to do that, it doesn't work. The church, the witnesses of the church continue to, you know, it might get pressed down, it might go underground, but it comes back up. And the church continues its work of proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ. But the beast wants to distort and destroy that image of God in the world. In recent history, I think we see the beast at work in our country. Marriage is under attack. Young people who in previous generations would get married are asking questions like, why would you want to get married when you can just live together? Why? What's the big deal? What's the difference? And there's a huge difference. And that's not the sermon this morning, but there's a huge difference. But the beast has tricked young people in our world to say, there's no difference. You just kind of go with whatever you want to do. It's the result of blasphemous words that have been uttered over and over and over again until people start believing that they're actually true. Anytime a government passes a law that encourages or forces people to go against God's design for holy and righteous living, the beast is at work in that government. This doesn't happen only through the hands of a government entity. I mean, we could see all other ways that that happens, but when the government gets behind it, and you have no place to turn for protection from people who are trying to force you into the mold of the beast, then the persecution and the suffering just goes to a whole new level. You know, we can think of governments throughout history and around the world that have committed atrocities toward their own people, attempting to force its citizens to submit to its rules and its way of doing things. You know, we've read of raids on churches, re-education camps, Siberian prison camps. All those things come to mind of ways that the beast has worked to try to squeeze people into its mold, to try to make people like the beast. But as I've already mentioned, we have to recognize that sometimes the beast strikes much closer to home than we would like to admit. Now, I want to preface what I'm going to say by saying we live in a nation that has been greatly blessed by God, and I am so grateful to live in the United States. But if we think the beast, this human concrete representation of Satan, has never infiltrated our own government, then we are sadly mistaken. One example from the early 1900s. The eugenics movement, I mentioned this just real briefly last week, the eugenics movement gained a lot of traction in the United States. 32 states had laws that allowed for forced sterilization of people who were deemed undesirable to reproduce, sometimes without even letting them know it was being done to them. 60,000 forced sterilizations using United States federal funds were performed between about 1920 in 1960, in an attempt to bring about a better society. Let's make the world a better place. Let's keep the people that we don't want around from reproducing and encourage the people who are good citizens to have more kids. We want to produce a better quality of citizen in the United States. World War II, Adolf Hitler just took what we were doing and took it to a whole nother level. Here's his quote. There is today one state in which at least weak beginnings toward a better conception of citizenship are noticeable. Of course, it is not our model German Republic, but the United States. These laws were tested. They went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, and this is part of the decision written by Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. We've seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for these lesser sacrifices, often not felt to be such by those concerned, in order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence. It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime, or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. If you're an Avengers fan, this is Hydra. Hydra was, we want to eliminate the people who might possibly commit crimes. And here we did a very similar thing. It's like, oh, these people are likely to commit crimes. They're likely to be a burden on society. And so we are going to force people to be sterilized so they can't reproduce. And as I did a little research into the eugenics movement, what concerned me even more than the United States being part of something that treated people who were created in the image of God like they were second-rate people. Supreme Court justices stating that the government has the authority to determine who is and who is not fit to reproduce. It's bad enough that the U.S. was behind this, but when I saw that a significant part of the Christian church in the United States was behind it, I was appalled. I saw a newspaper ad for the Correspondence School of Gospel and Scientific Eugenics. Harry Emerson Fosdick, a well-known Baptist preacher, although that may be a little bit of a loose term because he denied the virgin birth, the resurrection of Jesus, and the second coming of Christ. He had a radio show with 2 to 3 million listeners, and he served on the advisory board of the American Eugenics Society. Now, why do I bring up all of that baggage from the history of the church and the U.S. as we're thinking about this beast? Because there was a significant portion of the church in the United States that gave in to the beastliness that our culture was promoting when they should have resisted it and spoken up against it. Largely conservative and Catholic churches did oppose eugenics, but there were enough churches that called themselves Christian who not only didn't speak up against it, they adopted it. This was the way of bringing heaven to earth. And it's ironic that the way that some of the churches were saying we're bringing heaven to earth is by marginalizing and mistreating the least of these in society, which is pretty much the opposite of what Jesus told us to do. We, the church, cannot give in to the beast. We must resist beastliness through faith and endurance. Verse 8 divides the world's population into two groups, those who worship the beast and those whose name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And throughout Revelation, there are two groups. Earlier I mentioned there are heaven dwellers and earth dwellers. And then verse 9 says, if anyone has an ear, let him hear. And what are they supposed to hear? Verse 10, if anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. And then, here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. See, this is what I believe John is telling the church. This is his call to the church. You need to be prepared to choose captivity rather than submit to the beast's teaching. You need to be prepared to lay down under a sword rather than sit by and let people follow the beast all the way to hell. And it's going to take endurance and faith. It needs faith. You're fighting the same enemy as in chapter 12, the dragon. He just looks different. There's a concrete representation. You overcome the dragon. You overcome the beast by the blood of the Lamb and the word of his testimony. You confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord. You believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. You trust Jesus to take your sin on himself and to give you his righteousness. And this is not some type of a shell game. I think sometimes we might look at the gospel and think it's kind of a trick. Well, we're really sinful, but Jesus gives us his righteousness, so God looks at us and he really sees Jesus' righteousness, even though I'm full of sin. And that's not the gospel. The gospel is Jesus imputes his righteousness to you. His righteousness becomes your righteousness. When you stand before God as a believer in Christ, your sin is not there. It's gone. It's been put on Jesus at the cross, and you are given his righteousness. It's yours now through faith in Jesus. It has to start with faith. If you are going to resist the beast, it has to start with faith, but you also need endurance. In the next chapter, there's a very similar verse with an added description. Revelation chapter 14, verse 12. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I believe that helps us understand what John means by endurance. He means we need to continue to obey Jesus. We need to know his word. We need to follow his teaching. We need faith and endurance. Faith without endurance or obedience is dead. Faith that doesn't have obedience to God is a dead faith. A lack of obedience really indicates that the faith is not really there. But we can obey with a beastly heart. We can obey the commands of Jesus because we think it's going to make our life better now, rather than out of love for Jesus. We can obey because we're trying to work our way to God, because we think we can somehow do enough good things to earn our way to heaven. That's beastly obedience. We can obey because we're just rule followers, and we're afraid of what might happen if we disobey. We need both faith in Jesus and enduring obedience that is coming out of a heart of love for Jesus. A love for Jesus because he first loved us by giving up his life for us on the cross. So who is like the beast? Are you like the beast? And we're all tempted by this beast in some way. If you don't think you're tempted to be like the beast, then watch out, because you're probably tempted and you don't even realize it. Now, why would I say that with such confidence? It's because even though you are created in the image of God, you have a beastly side. You have a sin nature that is still inside of you. You have desires and cravings that, if left unchecked and are indulged the way a wild beast indulges its cravings and desires, it will take you down a path of beastliness. Now, your path of beastliness might not look like a wild beast. Your path of beastliness could be something like, well, I want people to think well of me, and I will do whatever I need to do. I will say whatever I need to say so that people think highly of me. I'll do whatever I need to do to get the respect of people. So your life might look great, but inwardly you're consumed by the fear of man. You're consumed by what other people think of you rather than what honors God with your life. Your path of beastliness could be hidden. You know, you look at stuff on your computer or your phone that nobody knows about. There's a little voice inside your head that says, well, it's not hurting anybody. It's not bothering anybody else. But you're going down the path of beastliness, and it'll destroy you. Your beastliness could be valuing the things that you can see more than the things that you can't see. Valuing the things of this world and the things that you'll get to do in this life more than you value the things of eternity. You see, beasts have no self-control. Beasts just do everything to satisfy their wants and their desires and their cravings. And for you, child of God, that must be resisted. Because the abundant life, the easy yoke that Jesus promises to us, comes through dying to ourselves, taking up our cross, following Jesus. Someone who tries to save this life and just suck the marrow out of this life will ultimately lose his or her life. But whoever loses this life because he sees a better life to come will save his life. The beast wants you to try and get every possession, every experience, everything you want in these few short years that you are on earth. And here's the thing, he might just give you everything you want. He might just give you the fulfillment of every desire you have so that the dragon can have you for all of eternity. The irony in our society is that we celebrate beastliness. We celebrate giving in to the desires that we have. The cardinal sin is to tell someone they want what they want something, they want to live in a certain way. To tell them that's wrong is a cardinal sin. Who are you to say that what they want is wrong? It's not me, it's God. What God says is right and wrong. You know, but we celebrate that. Somebody is a great football player or basketball player. What do you say? Somebody who can't be stopped on the court. That guy's a beast. And it sounds like a good thing to us. But the beast is evil. The beast destroys. Letting your beastly self take over and just do whatever you want to do or whatever is easiest is really slavery to sin. And it leads to destruction. So I want to encourage you, brothers and sisters in Christ, don't give in to the beast. Resist the temptation to beastliness that is coming from the pit of hell. Trust in God through faith in Jesus, through obedience to his word. Press on in resisting the temptation to submit to the beast and let him conform you to his image.